Welcome to the LSE Ideas Seminar, the Africa group of the Ideas group. We are very fortunate to have Daniel Volman here. He's the director of the Africa Security Research Project in Washington and a member of the board of directors of the U.S. Association of Concerned African Scholars. He's been specializing for 30 years in questions of security, U.S. security, with respect to Africa and generally military activities connected to Africa. So really, I don't think there's a better person to give us his overview of AFRICOM and the Obama position on that, and whether this as the title of the seminar suggests, represents a militarization of the policy towards Africa. Dr. Volman.
It's my pleasure. I'm going to stand so I can see all of you and you can see me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I want to thank Chris for inviting me and Sue Onslow and the staff for organizing this event. I'm going to be talking sort of in fairly general terms about the new U.S.-Africa Command, partly because I want to leave as much time as possible for questions and discussion, but also because I'll refer you to, if you look at the website of the African Security Research Project, you can find the extensive articles and reports that I've written over the last, probably over the last 5 or 6 years, which are full of information and data and citations, so I encourage you to follow up on that. Also, just to mention that although I'm basically going to be talking about U.S. national security policy towards Africa, U.S. military activities on the continent, that I also do research and writing more in the last couple of years on the increasing role of India and China and the reemergence of Russia as a major actor on the African continent. And if people want to ask questions about that a little later on, I'd be happy to talk about that. And I'm going to basically most of the information that I rely upon, most of that I'm going to be talking about here today, is information that I obtained from the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, and other official U.S. government documents, but primarily the Pentagon itself, because the U.S. Department of Defense goes to an enormous amount of time and trouble to put vast amounts of information about what it's doing in Africa, as well as other parts of the world, puts it up on its own website, which is, I'll just give you the URL, it's www.defenselink.mil, and just to suggest that if any of you are interested in doing research on this, that you go to that website. I'm also more than happy to share my own research and work with anyone who's interested. And I'm going to leave a pile of cards here. Anyone who wants to take one, feel free to get in touch with me. More than happy to share my information and also to help people do their own research on these issues. Because as I said, U.S. Defense Department goes to an enormous amount of time and trouble to put out news stories and a whole set of think tanks and universities generating reports and studies with a lot of really valuable information. In fact, information which is often quite critical of U.S. military policy towards Africa. Some of the most effective critiques of the new U.S. Africa Command that I've read were actually written by serving U.S. military officers, particularly a report written by a U.S. Air Force intelligence officer on the critique of the U.S. global war on terrorism. So a lot of what I'm saying is, in fact, reflected in the kind of thinking that comes from the professional military officers who actually run U.S. military policy, not from sort of the political level at the top, but from the professional military officers who actually run U.S. military activity. So I'm going to be talking from explaining, as many of you I'm sure know, the U.S. In October 1st of 2008, officially inaugurated a new combatant command, that's the official term for these regional military commands for the African continent, called Africa Command, or in Pentagon shorthand, AFRICOM. But this is the culmination of a series of developments which actually began roughly 10 to 12 years earlier. Previous to the creation of the new Africa Command, U.S. military involvement in the African continent was handled by three separate commands. U.S. Military involvement in most of the continent was actually handled by the U.S. European Command, because for most of the Cold War and for a number of years thereafter, the U.S. felt that it could safely leave hands of the European colonial powers, and after independence, the former colonial powers, that if there was a crisis in Africa, that the U.S. could rely upon its European allies to handle those crises, as generally was the case, and it could therefore handle its policy towards Africa essentially through European command and its direct relations with European countries. Beginning in 1979, the Horn of Africa became part of the area of responsibility of what's known as the U.S. Central Command, which is established beginning in 1979 to fulfill the pledge made by President Jimmy Carter that henceforth the United States would be willing to use its own military forces to ensure the free flow of oil out of the Middle East, because many of the major transit routes for that oil, particularly the transit routes to Europe, but also the routes leading around the Cape of Good Hope into the United States from the Middle East, went by the Horn of Africa and East Africa. Those were part of the area of responsibility of U.S. Central Command. And then Madagascar and the island republics in the Indian Ocean were part of the area of responsibility of U.S. Pacific Command. Now, I meant that U.S. policy towards Africa and U.S. military policy was a relatively minor feature, because European command, of course, had primary responsibility for all of Europe, for relations with Russia, the former Soviet republics. Central command's primary focus was on the Middle East, and of course is now deeply engaged in two major wars in the Middle East. Pacific Command has responsibility for the entire Pacific Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and U.S. military relations with all of East and South Asia, particularly China and India. So Africa was a very subordinate part of U.S. military strategy until the late 1990s, at which point U.S. policymakers began to perceive three major developments, particularly with regard to resources. And I'll talk about some of the other developments that led to the creation of AFRICOM in just a moment. But they began to see that three things were happening in terms of global demand for energy. First of all, that the world as a whole was reaching the condition known as peak oil, which is to say that world oil production had essentially reached maximum. It might remain at a plateau for a while, but that it would inevitably begin to decline in the future, because the large, easily accessible sources of oil had been tapped and brought into production many years before. They were beginning to become exhausted, that all the new sources of oil would become available. They were going to be much smaller, in many cases much less accessible and much more difficult to develop. And the one area that, in fact, American policymakers began to understand very early on, about 10 years ago, would become one of the few parts of the world where new sources of oil would become available to the United States, but also to anyone else, was going to be Africa. The only other part of the world where significant new amounts of oil were going to be developed was Central Africa, which, of course, would require the construction of very expensive, long pipelines. It was going to be much more expensive to develop and would only be developed many, many decades in the future because of all the conflicts about where the pipelines would be built, raising the funding to build them. But that in the next 10, 20, 30 years, Africa was the only part of the world where significant new amounts of oil were going to become available for the United States or for any of the other major importers. And the second thing that they began to perceive was that as countries around the world, particularly India and China, began to rapidly industrialize, that they were going to be competing with the United States for what sources of oil were available, that they were also going to become much more dependent on African oil, and that they were going to dramatically increase their oil production and their demand for a whole host of other resources, copper, cobalt, coltan, which I don't know if you're not familiar with it, is a vital ingredient in cell phones and computer games and modern computer electronics, but also to the sort of more mundane raw materials like copper and cobalt necessary for the production of consumer goods were going to be in much greater demand, particularly by China, as it rapidly industrialized and began exporting vast amounts of consumer goods to Europe and even more to the United States. And as a result, there was going to be growing competition between the United States and other countries for access to African resources. And it's at that point that the United States began to conclude that it was necessary to become much more directly involved in Africa and in an effort to use America's military power. America was then triumphing itself as the world's only global superpower, that it would use that military power in the hopes that that would guarantee not just the United States, but the whole world access to those resources coming out of Africa. Now, the second thing that happened in the late 1990s was, of course, the beginning of what's now called the global war on terrorism, because, in fact, one of the first attacks launched by al-Qaeda against American targets was the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. So many years, 3 years before the events of September 11th, the United States also was already beginning to conclude that Africa was a primary battlefield in the global war on terrorism. And the third factor that comes into play beginning in the late 1990s is because of the competition between the United States and China for access to Africa's resources, the potential for competition, if not conflict, and I'll talk about that in a moment, between the United States and China as they both sought to gain and maintain access to Africa's resources. So it's at that point the United States begins to dramatically expand and increase its military involvement on the African continent, an area that it had previously neglected for the most part. This took the form of a whole series of programs, including arms sales to African countries, military training programs, both programs where the United States sends its own military personnel to Africa to train African forces there, but also programs where the United States brings African military officers to the United States for training at U.S. Military bases and other naval facilities. The United States also established its first major military base on the African continent, which is located in Djibouti, which not coincidentally is just north of Somalia, a primary focus of U.S. concern about al-Qaeda connections and involvement in the global war on terrorism. The U.S. also began to dramatically expand its naval presence off the coast of Africa, both off the oil-rich Gulf of Guinea and off the coast of Somalia. In addition to this build-up around Africa, the United States also sought to conclude what are known as base access agreements, that rather than try to establish a large number of very expensive, highly visible military bases on the African continent, what the United States needed was access to local military facilities in as many different parts of the continent as possible. Didn't have to make significant base improvements at these locations, it just needed access to them, because the United States has the capability of establishing large-scale military bases in essentially 24 hours. When the President of the United States, or more recently when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton traveled to Africa, they essentially bring a U.S. military base along with them, because they bring thousands and thousands of Marines to provide security. They bring along a whole stockpile of military and non-military equipment to support their activities. They bring along a very sophisticated communications system so they can communicate back and forth to Washington. They bring in, of course, all the planes and other equipment they need to move in and out of these countries. They don't need big bases in Africa. What they need is access to as many different parts of the continent prearranged as possible. So they concluded these kinds of arrangements with roughly a dozen countries all over the continent, because they have no idea where they may be required to intervene directly, and they want to have access to as many places as possible. And just to give you an idea, I'll sort of just list the countries that have already signed these agreements: Algeria, Botswana, Gabon, Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Namibia, Sao Tome, Sierra Leone, Tunisia, Uganda, and Zambia. And as you can tell, these are all over the continent that give the United States access, whenever it requires it, to base facilities everywhere around the continent. But they can say, when they're asked, does the U.S. have a base in Ghana, they can say no, and technically they're telling the truth. What they don't, of course, go on to explain is, yes, but we already have an agreement with the government of Ghana that whenever we want to use their military bases, those will be available to us. In addition, the U.S. naval buildup off the coast of Africa also essentially serves the function of floating military bases, because some of these deployments are as large as aircraft carrier battle groups, where you're talking about an aircraft carrier with dozens of combat planes, thousands and thousands of Marines, amphibious assault ships, armed attack helicopters, an enormous capability of bringing firepower to bear, not just on the coast of Africa, but anywhere that they choose, because they have the kind of refueling capability of operating far into the interior. So the Navy, in fact, likes to trumpet its capability of serving as essentially floating military bases. And finally, because the Pentagon, although it's very much opposed to the idea, knows that it may be required at some point in the future to actually conduct direct military intervention in Africa, they're also beginning to draw contingency plans and what are known as conduct war game scenarios to prepare the kind of planning that would be necessary for military intervention in Africa. And one of the main series of these war game scenarios is conducted by the U.S. Army War College, and until the spring of 2008, they do four of these every spring. They had never done one for Africa, but in the spring of 2008, for the first time, they did two war game scenarios for Africa. One of them was for Somalia. We don't know very much about that because the people who were involved didn't go very public with that. But the other one was for Nigeria, and the people who were involved in that were essentially, pardon the colloquialism, they were so freaked out at what they were being asked to discuss that they went very, very public with what happened in these war game scenarios. And it's my analysis that one of the reasons they did that is that they really don't want to get the order to go into Nigeria, and they're trying to alert the American public in the hopes that the American people can do something to make sure they never get that order. Because the scenario, the war game simulations, they take about a week, and they're sort of like the role-playing games that some of you may be familiar with from your computers, that different military officers play different roles. One of them plays the President of the United States, one of them plays the President of Nigeria, one of them plays the Secretary of State, etc. And they began with the premise that the fundamental threat to the flow of oil out of the Niger Delta, wasn't men or the insurgent groups in the Niger Delta. It was the Nigerian government itself, which in their analysis was so greedy and short-sighted that in their words, it seemed bent on committing suicide. And the scenario the premise they began with was that conflict within the Nigerian elite was going to reach the point, and the scenario was set in the year 2013. So they were talking just 5 years into the future. It wasn't a prediction, it was just sort of a hypothetical date that gives you some idea of their thinking, that the Nigerian elite would fragment and the different elements of the Nigerian government would begin fighting for control of the oil resources of the Niger Delta. And that's what would threaten and bring an end to oil exports from Nigeria. And that was the premise of the scenario. So they then began to explore what are the options for the United States, how could the United States respond. And they ran through sort of a number of alternatives. Maybe we can get the South Africans to intervene. They quickly concluded that that was unlikely to happen and in any case would not be very effective. And they thought, well, maybe we can get the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, to intervene clandestinely. But because their analysis was that the Nigerian elite was so greedy and self-sided that it was bent on committing suicide, they concluded that that wouldn't work either. And they reached a point in the war game where essentially they saw only two options possible, that the Secretary of Defense would have an option paper to present to the President of the United States, and there would be basically only two options on that. One is that the President could go in front of the American people and say, okay, we've lost access to Nigeria, and just to sort of backtrack the importance of oil and all of this, the United States now gets more oil from the African continent than it does from the entire Middle East. The United States has successfully diversified away from the Middle East, but it's only done that by becoming more dependent on Africa's oil exports. And Nigeria is now the fifth largest supplier of U.S. oil imports. The United States gets roughly 10% of its oil now, of its imported oil, from Nigeria. And although 90% of America's oil imports might continue to flow, the loss of 10% of your total imports would have an enormous, really devastating impact on the American economy and more directly on the American people, because they would go to their gas stations, there would be no gasoline, they would go to their stores, and there would be no food in their stores because the food is all brought in by truck, and more of it is brought into the United States on ships, which again depend on petroleum. So one of the options that they conceived of was that the President of the United States could essentially go on television and say to the American people, I'm sorry, there's no gasoline at your gas stations, and there's nothing I can do about it. Now, which is essentially to commit political suicide in the United States, because nothing is more important in terms of public support for any administration than its ability to produce reliable and relatively inexpensive supplies of gasoline to the American people. And the only other option they could come up with was to send 20,000 American troops into the Niger Delta in the hopes that somehow those troops could get the oil flowing again. But the professional military officers, these are people I talk to all the time, these are smart people. They know that there is, in fact, no way the military could possibly get the oil flowing again. There is no military strategy that can make sure that oil flows. Oil burns and explodes. It's impossible for any military force to protect it, that they could send in 20,000 troops, they could send in, and that would only be the first initial deployment, because they would fail. They would keep, the inevitable logic is to keep sending in more troops, but there was no way they could possibly get the oil flowing out of the Niger Delta, particularly trying to fight with insurgents and the Nigerian government. There's no way they could protect the oil production. And because professional military officers take their responsibility to the young men and women under their command very seriously, they really didn't want to even think about what would be involved if they actually sent American troops into the Niger Delta, because they would then start coming back in body bags to the United States. And these are the military officers who would have to send the letters home, you know, dear sir or madam, your son or daughter has died in combat. And they really don't want to have to be in that position unless it's for some purpose that they see as being militarily possible. And they clearly understand that there is no military strategy that can really keep the oil flowing. So at that point, they sort of came up with an imaginary end to the scenario, which is that somebody in Nigeria stages a military coup, establishes a democratic government, establishes justice in Nigeria, and then everything is fine, which even they understand is a complete fantasy, but it demonstrates how much they don't even want to think about the idea of deploying U.S. troops in places like Nigeria. But they understand that if the situation in Nigeria reaches the point that they in fact anticipate it reaching, there would be really irresistible pressure on any American president. 2013 would be sort of roughly just after, assuming President Obama is reelected, would be early in his second term, but whoever is in office at that point, there would be irresistible pressure. If you're the president of the United States, you're the only world's global superpower, you have to do something, and the only thing you have at your disposal as a political leader is to send in the troops. Now, I think President Obama understands the dilemma that he's in, but he's only going to be in office for a maximum of 8 years, and any sort of alternative strategy to create an alternative to military intervention is going to take decades to come to fruition. That the only options he's going to have are military force or doing nothing, and the pressure on him to do something, no matter how crazy or stupid it is, would be overwhelming. So the military officers who are running this scenario understand that if that point comes, there's really no alternative. There's nothing they can look forward to except getting the order from whoever is president of the United States to send in the troops. Now, all of these programs were very much intended, the real preference on the part of the Pentagon is to strengthen the ability of the generally repressive, undemocratic regimes, which either govern major oil-producing countries, or like Nigeria, Algeria, Angola, Chad, there's a long list of these, or the regimes which the U.S. relies upon as its proxies or surrogates in the global war on terrorism, particularly Kenya and Ethiopia. The hope is that this military assistance will make it possible for them to to act on the behalf of the United States, so the United States doesn't have to become directly involved. But as the sort of the Nigeria scenario illustrates, they understand this is a strategy which is likely to fail at some point in the future, that by backing these repressive, undemocratic regimes, by being an obstacle to democracy and real development in most of these countries, that you're creating a situation in which violence and chaos is only going to continue, terrorism is only going to continue to expand, and that ultimately the only alternative you're going to have is to send in your own troops. So that brings that all of this sort of growing military involvement, both indirect and direct, has dramatically expanded over the last 10 to 12 years. And in my estimation, it's risen from a total value of something in the order of $100 to $200 million a year in about 2001, to the point where today it's now running at something like $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year. And that doesn't include some of the costs, which are sort of harder to calculate, the amounts of money which are being funneled into private military contractors, for example, which are more and more involved as part of U.S. military involvement in Africa, or the costs of naval activities off the coast of Africa, which are sort of hard to disaggregate from the overall cost of the Navy, but it covers sort of most of the military activities that I've been discussing. And in order to administer this dramatic expansion of U.S. military involvement in Africa, they've been talking for about 10 years about the creation of a new Africa command, a separate command within the Pentagon to administer all of this activity. Also, a command which, because a combatant command, because previously when African military affairs were handled by three separate commands, that meant that there wasn't anyone going to Congress directly responsible for Africa and able to get the kind of funding that they would like to get, in addition to the funding that they're already getting. So when you create a new command like this, it has to be commanded by a four-star general, and they very much wanted an African-American four-star general. They really only had one choice, so they appointed General William Ward, and he was now required every year as part of the budget process to go to Congress and to make a personal testimony in order to justify the kind of increased spending in the hopes of getting additional increased spending out of Congress. I think that's another purpose behind the creation of the new command. And I think sort of one of the third purposes is to serve as a demonstration of America's determination to at least compete with the kind of high-level, very sophisticated activities that the Chinese government has been engaged in for a number of years in Africa. That it's really the only institution within the United States government which is directly focused on U.S. relations with Africa, and it's in part a demonstration of America's willingness to compete primarily through military instruments with the Chinese in Africa. Now, from the point of view of most of the people at the Pentagon, the U.S. Defense Department, there's no inherent conflict between the United States and China over Africa or over the globe, because, in fact, from their point of view, the United States and China have a lot of strong common interests in Africa. Particularly, they both have a common interest in providing the kind of military and security assistance that keeps these repressive, undemocratic regimes in power. So it's not surprising that the fact that the Chinese are involved in supplying arms and other military assistance to countries like Sudan and Zimbabwe, they're essentially following the model established by the United States of supplying large amounts of military equipment to countries like Algeria, Nigeria, Chad, Angola, etc. And then in addition, that there's no inherent conflict between the United States and China when it comes to China's growing activity of Chinese oil corporations and investments in China, because those simply make it possible to increase Africa's oil production. So that in fact, the Chinese oil companies, which are now more and more involved, particularly in countries like Angola and Nigeria, actually sell most of their oil to the United States. On the other hand, China is now buying more and more of its oil from Saudi Arabia, where it's all being produced by American oil companies. That is, both the U.S. and China operate essentially as free market capitalist powers. they have a common interest in expanding oil production throughout the world. So all of this has led to the creation of the Africa Command, which was fully and finally inaugurated in October of 2008, just over a year ago. And, of course, that was just less than a month before the American elections, the victory of Barack Obama, and the inauguration of the Obama administration soon thereafter. And as far as all the evidence that I've seen suggests, the administration of President Obama has essentially continued to follow the same trajectory laid down by both the Bush administration and by the Clinton administration, because this whole trajectory began, as I said, about 10 or 12 years ago, which was the second term of President William Clinton. In particular, this reflects the fact that President Obama genuinely believes in the global war on terrorism, which I think is a fundamental error of analysis, but it's very clearly something that he's committed to, and that although he understands the dilemma of U.S. Dependence on oil imports from very volatile countries around the world, he doesn't see any quick way out of that situation. He is, in fact, interested in developing alternatives, a way of getting out of this trap, to develop alternative energy supplies, to reduce America's demand for oil imports. But he understands that none of that is going to happen quickly. It's going to take decades and decades to develop. It's going to cost enormous amounts of money. Much of it may not even be technologically feasible. It's not clear that we're actually ever going to get to what's been described as the post-petroleum era. And that in any case, as long as he's president, his immediate problem is what does he do when the oil stops flowing from a place like Nigeria. There's a result in his first budget request for fiscal year 2010, the fiscal year which began, at least technically, in October of this year. He's asking for more money for arms sales to African countries, more money for military training programs in Africa, more money for the AFRICOM headquarters in Stuttgart, Germany, more money for the AFRICOM base in Djibouti, more money for U.S. naval activities around the continent, and the like. And in fact, when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made her tour of the continent as she went to different countries, she reinforced this pledge. The United States would provide additional sources of military and security assistance to all of these oil-producing countries and all these countries which were major allies of the United States in the global war on terrorism. And in fact, she went beyond that, because when she was in Nigeria and had meetings with the Nigerian defense minister, she came out of those meetings and made remarks to the press in which she said, in addition to all the military support that we've already promised the Nigerian government, if they have any requests for additional material, for additional military support to be used specifically in the Niger Delta, we'll be happy to accommodate them. So as far as I can tell, although there were a lot of expectations that the Obama administration would be less militaristic and, yes, less unilateral in its military policy towards Africa and other parts of the world, that simply hasn't been the case. They're following the same trajectory laid down in the previous administrations.